Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Alzheimer's is a neurological disease that tends to develop over many years, but usually doesn't show symptoms until later in life. And for most, by the time the disease reveals itself, it's too late to treat. That approach may be changing to one of prevention, and that might include medication, lifestyle, and diet. In her TED Talk in April, noted neuroscientist and novelist Lisa Genova talked about the changing tack of Alzheimer's research. She is the author of the novels Still Alice in 2007 and Inside the O'Briens in 2016. Both plots revolve around the topic of early onset Alzheimer's disease. Lisa Genova joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Researchers are now looking at prevention. That's what you talked about in April. What had they been working on, and what changed their course?
Well, a couple of things. So the idea, we don't have a good predictor of Alzheimer's right now. So that's sort of cheap and non-invasive. We don't have a blood test like we do for heart disease, where you can go and find out if you have high cholesterol, which would indicate that you're at risk for heart disease, or truly non-invasive, like a blood pressure cuff. If you have high blood pressure, you're at risk for heart disease. We have right now for Alzheimer's, we have a PET scan that images for amyloid, which is the bad guy that we think starts the cascade of molecular events that cause Alzheimer's. That's very expensive, not covered by insurance. So we can't see early on whether someone is likely to develop Alzheimer's. We tend to know when someone does have it, and that diagnosis can take years for some people. So we're used to seeing people when they're in the full throes of the disease. And so scientists have been busy trying to cure that and treat that. The problem is we now believe, we've noticed in clinical trials, so the clinical trials to date to find a drug that will stop disease progression, that will change the course of the disease, have failed. And we think that part of the reason they may have failed is that we're giving these drugs to people who are already symptomatic. And so it's a bit too late in the course of the development of the disease. We think that amyloid builds up for 15 to 20 to 25 years before a person becomes symptomatic. And so the drugs that are aimed at eliminating or reducing amyloid, we really need to give those before someone becomes symptomatic with Alzheimer's for it to be effective. The analogy I use in the talk, which is really sort of helpful for people, think of the compounds that scientists are developing that are attacking amyloid as aiming to blow out a match. So amyloid accumulation is a lit match. The drugs are aimed at blowing that match out. Well, they're treating people when the match has already set fire to the forest. So even if you blow out the match, it doesn't do any good. You've got a brain ablaze with Alzheimer's.
And the point being that it is ablaze by the time the symptoms emerge.
Yeah. So if we want to attack Alzheimer's by going after amyloid, we really have to get early. There are also there's a lot of research being done, like when the brain is ablaze with Alzheimer's, what can we do at that point? Because while the idea of preventing Alzheimer's is really intriguing, and I think that we'll see, eventually I think that's what we'll see. It's the simplest solution. It's what we do for heart disease. We don't wait till someone has a myocardial infarction, the heart attack. We don't wait till someone has congestive heart failure to say, well, we think you should now go on a statin and a baby aspirin. We do that 20, 30 years so that we hope that they never get to that point. So I think that's what we'll eventually see for Alzheimer's. But for the millions of folks who already have it, we also would like to have a strategy for treating them so that they don't progress any further, and maybe even there's a possibility of reversing it. So scientists are working on neuroinflammation, and all of the cascade of events that follow amyloid beta reaching a tipping point and setting prior to the forest.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Lisa Genova. She's a neuroscientist and also an author. You might be familiar with her 2007 book, Still Alice. It was made into a movie. If you have a question or comment for Lisa Genova, give us a call. We're talking about Alzheimer's right now. Coming up, we're going to talk about the daily care of Alzheimer's and what it costs people. We're going to hear from a local caregiver, and we'll also hear from people doing that kind of research that Lisa Genova talked about in her recent TED Talk in April. It feels like the dog chasing its tail right now when we're talking about this. 5 million Americans currently have Alzheimer's. They've been diagnosed with it. They're saying it could triple by 2050. Is that just because our population's growing or what? Why the tripling effect? Is it because people are living longer? What do we know?
Yeah, both of those things. So in the year 1900, our average life expectancy was 45. It's now somewhere between 70 and 80, and it's expected to increase. Our lifespan is increasing, which is wonderful, but our brain span isn't keeping up. Hmm. And then the other piece is the baby boomers. We've got this gigantic population of people who are aging into 70s, 80s, and are expecting to live well into old age, and yet age is the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's. So yeah, we're anticipating an explosion that could very realistically bankrupt our healthcare system if we don't do something.
It's strongly correlated with heart disease, right?
Yeah. So there's this idea of is there just nothing we can do about this? We can't do anything about getting older. We can't do anything about the genes that we've inherited that, some combination of those will likely increase or decrease our risk and maybe tip the scale toward increasing it. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, and so I've likely inherited a gene or two or more that maybe increased my risk eventually of getting it. But is there nothing you can do? No. In fact, there's a lot you can do. And likewise, I like to keep using heart disease as an example for folks, because this used to be something that just, heart disease was just, there was nothing we could do about it maybe 40, 50 years ago. And now people aren't quite as afraid of it. And there's so much fear around Alzheimer's. And part of that fear comes from the sense that there's nothing we can do. And so like heart disease, anything that's good for your heart is going to help protect you from Alzheimer's. So, and the flip of that, anything that's bad for your heart is going to increase your risk of Alzheimer's. So we know that high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, and smoking all increase your risk of developing Alzheimer's. So anything you can do to combat that. So exercise, we know that aerobic exercise actually clears away amyloid beta, that bad guy that starts this disease, more than any pharmaceutical we've discovered so far. We know that if you have type 2 diabetes, you have double the risk of Alzheimer's. So managing that or preventing diabetes. So a heart-healthy lifestyle, Mediterranean diet, keeping cholesterol low, all of those are things that you can do to keep your risk of Alzheimer's low.
Interesting connection to sleep. You mentioned that sleep could be a factor in developing Alzheimer's. If we don't get enough, there's a rinse that occurs when we're sleeping at night that helps rinse away those amyloids. But the onset of Alzheimer's also affects sleep patterns, right? So again, another vicious cycle.
That's a vicious cycle. Yeah. And that's relatively new scientific research that is very strong and compelling. And it's something that we can do to prevent Alzheimer's. So the idea that, I think a lot of us are very busy burning the candle at both ends and compromising our sleep, thinking that that's maybe not affecting anything. We now understand that in slow wave deep sleep, our glial cells, these cells in our brain, rinse cerebral spinal fluid throughout the synapses in our brains, and they clear away metabolic waste that accumulated while we're in the business of being awake. And one of the things it clears away is amyloid beta. But what happens if you don't get enough sleep? If you don't get that slow wave deep sleep, then the glial cells didn't have the time to do what they need to do to clear things away. It's sort of like, if you went to bed with dishes in the sink, and someone was supposed to clean those up while you went to bed, and you woke up in the morning and that person didn't do their job, you start the day with dishes in the sink, and it's just more is going to pile up the next day. If you don't clear away your amyloid beta at night, more piles up during the business of being awake the next day, over time, this is going to lead to amyloid plaques, which if that accumulates, then you're heading toward Alzheimer's. And we also know there are a lot of studies that show once you do have Alzheimer's, once you have this amyloid plaque accumulation, that actually causes more to accumulate. So it is this once you sort of reach a certain point in the progress of this disease, it becomes much more difficult to prevent. So everybody get your sleep.
Yeah, I do my best because my grandmother had Alzheimer's as well. And I kind of wonder about it. And then I think, well, because of the job that I'm in, I'm constantly learning. Almost every single day I'm reading. There's a difference between doing crossword puzzles and just the kind of brain stimulation we need to offset this, right?
Yeah. And so the other thing, in addition to diet, exercise, and sleep, there's the idea of, like, well, even if this is going on in your brain, even if you've got some level of Alzheimer's, you've got some level of amyloid plaques blocking some of your synapses, so you neuron A can't communicate with neuron B. Well, what if you create neuron synapses, connections for communication, C, D, E, F, G, all the way through Z? Like, what if you learn more? So every time you learn something new, you are building and strengthening new synapses, new neural connections. This is why we continue to learn. And every time you learn something, your brain is changing. And so there's this sort of general idea out there in the public that, well, I'll do crossword puzzles and that will help keep me resistant to Alzheimer's. And while being mentally engaged is great, it's not to say crossword puzzles aren't engaging your brain. We can do a lot better than that. And just intuitively, you understand when you engage more of your senses, when you're doing something that you're emotionally involved in, I think it's hard to get emotionally involved in a crossword. If you do something that you're passionate about. So, you know, for me, that might be reading a book or going to dinner with friends. Conversation, social stimulation is really great for your brain. You're building more synapses. So learn to play Italian. When I get off the phone with you, I'm going to a ballroom dance class. Explore new cities, travel. This really does actually change your brain. You are making more synapses available to you. So if some of those become blocked by Alzheimer's, you have a way to detour around them. Think of your neurons as if they were roads. And if there's a roadblock on one street and you're trying to get to where you're going, well, if you have other avenues and boulevards and roads to detour that car accident or that wreckage or whatever is going on to block that street, you can still get to where you're going. If you only have the one road and that's blocked, stuck.
I thought that your TED Talk, you gave a really great visualization for me to understand what you just said. And that had to do, you know, you said, well, if you know Lisa Genova and all you know about her is that she wrote Still Alice, when that, you know, transmitter goes, you know, kapooey, that's all you're going to know. You're not going to have a memory of Lisa Genova.
Right. So if you develop Alzheimer's and it happens to infiltrate that synapse, the connection between Lisa Genova and Still Alice, then you've forgotten me forever. If someone says who wrote Still Alice or who is Lisa Genova, you have no idea. But if you learn more about me, if you know that I spoke with Ann Fisher on NPR, if you know that she lives on Cape Cod, she wrote Inside the O'Briens, which is about Huntington's disease. If you learn more about me, so you learn four things, and three of them become compromised by Alzheimer's disease, you still have a way to detour all of that damage and remember who I am.
Lisa Genova, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
We'll have a link to Lisa Genova's TED Talk on our website at WOSU.org/Alzheimer's. She's a neuroscientist and author of Still Alice. More on Alzheimer's disease coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Scientists who study treatments for Alzheimer's disease have taken that old adage to heart and increasingly are focusing clinical trials and research on stopping or delaying the disease before symptoms emerge. We just heard from neuroscientist and author Lisa Genova about her take on the disease and related research. Joining us now is education coordinator for the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Michelle Crum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
And by phone, director of the Memory and Brain Health Center at University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center, Dr. Alan Lerner. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Dr. Lerner, what do doctors and researchers know about why that plaque builds up in our brain the way it does?
The initial event of why you start developing plaques is really still unknown. And that is probably going to be the ultimate key to the cure of Alzheimer's disease as well as the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. What we do know, however, is that the plaques, which are made of a protein called amyloid, begin accumulating in the brain about 15 years prior to any clinical symptoms. In other words, somebody who starts developing memory loss at age 75, for example, may have started developing, having changes in their brain in their early 60s. And so the ideas that Lisa was talking about of brain training and keeping yourself active and making synapses and doing things is really a lifelong activity, you know, so no matter the same with physical activity, so that by the time you're starting to see symptoms, you're really dealing with a process that's been going on for a very long time.
When you're talking about making synapses, is the actual process of making those synapses, is that blowing off some of those amyloid plaques, or is it preventing the plaques from taking hold?
It's a complicated relationship. I think that amyloid as it builds up, injures the nerve cells, and so not as many synapses are being formed. You're taking cells out of your network as it is. Imagine if this was your computer and I started just taking little pieces of it out. At some point, it's going to start working oddly and then possibly stop working.
Cognitive training, blood pressure management, and physical activity, you know, are all part of working on that cognitive decline.
Right.
And why? What does blood pressure management have to do with a plaque that forms in your brain?
We know that hypertension, high blood pressure, is a risk factor for dementia of several different kinds. It's a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. It's also a risk factor for so-called vascular dementia, that dementia meaning loss of memory severe enough to cause problems with social and daily functioning. So vascular dementia, which is due to strokes and damage to the blood vessels, is another major cause of dementia.
Is vascular dementia Alzheimer's?
No, but we know that pure Alzheimer's disease is actually rarer and rarer as you're looking at older and older populations, so that by the time somebody's into their mid-80s, only about 10% of cases of Alzheimer's disease are quote-unquote pure without any other problems, scars in the brain, small strokes, evidence of Parkinson's disease, or other problems frequently complicate Alzheimer's disease.
No, go ahead.
So that the idea of a pure Alzheimer's state is actually a rarity.
So with all the research that's going on that I was talking about with Lisa Genova, and I want to talk about more thoroughly with you, is that research that's looking at just pure Alzheimer's, or could it apply to vascular dementia as well?
We've just completed the so-called SPRINT study, which is a large hypertension study that enrolled 9,500 people throughout the United States, including many in the Columbus region. And part of that was so-called SPRINT MIND study, the results of which we don't have, to see whether getting your blood pressure either at 140 over 90 or 120 over 80 might actually prevent cognitive loss.
Regardless of what's causing it.
That's correct.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Dr. Alan Lerner. He's director of the Memory and Brain Health Center at University Hospitals of Cleveland Medical Center. Also with me, Michelle Crum. She's the education coordinator for the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michelle Crum, I'm going to talk with Dr. Lerner a little bit more about the research that's being done, but why do you think it's important for people to understand or to do their best to understand what's going on here when it comes to dementia, whatever form, and especially Alzheimer's?
I think it's important for people to realize that it's not a normal part of aging and for people to understand those warning signs so that they can bring them to the doctor's attention.
But so warning signs are one thing, but understanding what kind of research is out there, is that important?
Very much so. As the doctor referred, the thought is that the plaques and tangles are developing 15 years prior to the symptoms showing. So we have a program called Trial Match through the Alzheimer's Association, and we really encourage individuals of all different abilities, health levels, to enroll and participate in studies that they might qualify for, because we need people to participate in trials that are they're healthy and non-symptomatic so that we can have better knowledge of prevention.
And if they know more about what's going on, they're more likely to do that.
Absolutely.
Huh. Dr. Lerner, can you talk about the A4 trial? How that compares and contrasts with what you did with the SPRINT trials?
Right. Just to amplify Michelle's comments here, you know, Alzheimer's disease and dementia is a major public health problem. Hundreds of billions of dollars are being spent on this annually. And the other idea is that early intervention has worked in many other diseases. Cancer, if the doctor said, well, let's wait for the pea-sized cancer to be a lemon-sized cancer, you'd run the other way. There's in many diseases, the idea of early intervention is key. The A4 trial is a groundbreaking study looking at the use of what is called a monoclonal antibody, a protein that is given via an intravenous infusion, to see whether or not that antibody, which binds to the amyloid plaques, can delay the development of memory problems. It's a international study, and it's enrolling about 1,300 people and following them for several years as compared to a placebo. And we're going to be able to see whether we can actually intervene. We've talked about things you can do for yourself, physical exercise, crossword puzzles, and we've talked about things that are medical. And this is a new dimension in trying to prevent this horrible disease.
And once the disease has taken hold, is any of the research looking at how to stop it from progressing? Is there a tipping point where it doesn't matter anymore, or anything to reverse the disease?
That's an excellent question. One of the major technological advances has been the ability to image amyloid using what's called PET scan or positron emission tomography. To me, this would have been science fiction when I started my career, this idea that you can actually see the buildup of the amyloid plaque. And so people who enter the A4 study are screened with this kind of advanced technology to see whether the plaque is building up.
Have you seen any PET scans that you go, whoa, I can't even believe this person's up and walking around and feeding themselves? I mean, do some people respond differently to the amount of plaque that's in their brain?
I think that is true. There is this concept called cognitive reserve, which is the idea that education and mental activities do help prevent the expression of Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. Of course, that only goes so far. And we all know people who are highly educated who might or do develop Alzheimer's disease in their late life. And so all that mental activity didn't, in the end, actually prevent it, though it might have altered its expression.
Michelle Crum, the more we learn about this, the more public knowledge, you know, general knowledge there is about this. Are you getting more inquiries from people wanting to find out, can I get a PET scan done? Can I get my genetic testing done? I want to know more about this.
We are, and we do a great amount of direction to the Trial Match program and also the programs that are available through Ohio State and Dr. Shari's team. The one impressive thing is that we're seeing calls come to us for those next steps. The families are getting earlier diagnosis, and they're coming, calling, saying, what are my next steps? And so we're able to do more early stage engagement programming, whether it's education or social engagement, memory strategies, art programs, exercise programs. We're able to do those programs with the individual with the disease as well as their care partner. So we're able to engage them and help build up their support team as they start to progress through the disease.
What about genetic testing, Dr. Lerner? Is that helpful for people to just get that done and find out if they have the gene?
We hadn't really thought so, but the data is accumulating that for the most common gene associated with late-onset Alzheimer's disease called apolipoprotein E or ApoE, the people who have one or particularly two copies of that gene are really at pretty high lifetime risk, as much as 70% over their lifetime. So the genie's out of the bottle on genetic testing in general. And, you know, we're seeing that now 23andMe, the genetic testing company, is offering ApoE testing. So I anticipate, and we really are seeing, more people coming in for, quote-unquote, cognitive baseline. My mom or my dad or both had dementia, maybe not as sharp. Tell me where I'm at. Do what you can. And that, too, is a very useful thing. Even if it doesn't result in treatment, they feel that they're sort of, you know, putting their line in the sand and saying, this is where I am, and we can be followed at yearly, maybe even over 10 years sometimes to see where that where it goes.
And Michelle Crum said that more people are calling in to say, how do I find out if I have this? There are more inquiries all the time. They direct them to the trials. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that it's a lot easier to find people to participate in the trials these days?
We have had quite a number of inquiries and people calling in and contacting us. I would say that the rush or the movement towards prevention has some downsides.
What is
and
it?
And that is that the field, by moving to prevention, has fewer studies for people with Alzheimer's disease, established disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it is coming at some cost. You know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent on prevention, which are certainly worth it. We are seeing relatively fewer studies for people with Alzheimer's disease, established disease. And so I feel we have to continue to not leave that group behind, okay? And that, to me, that's really a very serious issue.
Particularly people who have the early onset Alzheimer's?
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody. And
you know, they're a small percentage, but the larger group people, you know, the several million people we hear about, you know, 6 million, 7 million people are, you know, what are we doing for them?
Mm-hmm. They're saying that there are about 100 million people around the world?
That is correct. That's the World Health Organization estimate. It's an enormous number. It's a huge problem.
And it's also going to be hugely expensive, right? This is done.
Yeah.
This comes free. Sometimes, you know, it's going to be expensive. How in the world? I think you mentioned earlier, Dr. Lerner, it's a public health issue.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's tied in with the political changes, too, because Medicaid pays for almost two-thirds of nursing home stays. And so people with advanced disease who often end up in nursing homes, you know, so we're hearing about this daily. This has real implications down the road for people with Alzheimer's disease.
And for the people who, the rest of us, you know, everybody out there who's paying into the Medicaid system to support it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's next? I mean, they're talking about this preventative approach. You're saying it might come at the cost of curing people who already have it. Are there any other trials out there that are looking at other approaches when it comes to Alzheimer's?
Well, there's another protein that's involved called tau. Mm-hmm. And so we're beginning to see the development of anti-tau drugs also for prevention. The other somewhat bright spot in my mind is that there have been a number of studies that look at behavior in Alzheimer's disease, apathy, agitation, things of that sort, depression, which frequently are an accompaniment of the memory loss.
Yeah.
And we're actually starting to see some positive results on the behavior front. So memory may not be the easiest target. Behavior is another target. And so I think that for me, is something of a bright spot, and we're participating in a number of these studies.
Has memory been the target because it's the most noticeable symptom?
Yeah.
Yeah. And why is it, does the tau, do the amyloid plaque, do they go to certain parts of the brain, or do they go all over? Are they non-discriminating?
They seem to go all over. The location of the amyloid plaques actually does not correlate particularly well with memory symptoms. The location of tau protein actually does correlate pretty well with memory symptoms. So it starts in areas of the brain that are involved in short-term memory and what we call episodic memory. So I'm very excited about the idea that tau can be imaged similarly to amyloid, and that we may start to see the development of anti-tau drugs in the next several years. So that's going to be rolled out.
You know, when someone like you says it's sort of like science fiction from your childhood, mm-hmm. to be able to see these PET scans now, to be able to see the human brain in action in a live patient, it is pretty amazing. It's really only been the last 20 or so years, right?
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah. And what future technological advances do you think will affect your research going forward? Do you anticipate anything, or is this big enough?
Well, I think adaptive technology. I think we talked about early intervention, and early intervention suggests that you have to be able to identify it early. And so a lot of behavioral means are being, you know, apps and games are being devised that can give us a window into who might be at risk, not just age, mm-hmm. or symptoms. And I think adaptive technology and social supports are going to be our key. I think things that might be able to help the person say, oh, this is Jim, you know him from your church, and give that information in real time for somebody who can't remember names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we have to be able to use our imagination and all the tools that are available to us.
Well, we're going to talk about that more coming up. But for now, Dr. Alan Lerner, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you so much.
Dr. Alan Lerner is the director of the Memory and Brain Health Center at University Hospitals of Cleveland at the Cleveland Medical Center. More, like I said, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We've been talking about treating Alzheimer's disease. It's a neurological disorder that affects the brains of 5 million Americans. That number is expected to triple by 2050. That means the disease will affect nearly every American at some point, one way or another. The financial costs can be staggering, and the effort to care for a loved one, likewise. Still with us is Education Coordinator for the Central Ohio Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Michelle Crum. Michelle, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Deneen Day. She cares for her mother who has vascular dementia. Welcome to the show, Deneen.
Thank you.
Tell us about what vascular dementia is. Dr. Lerner mentioned it briefly, but go ahead.
Sure. It is caused by what we call small strokes or mini strokes. And over time, when someone has those mini strokes, it affects the vascular development in their brain and shards it up. And then it obviously impacts their cognitive and executive functions.
So it sort of comes on slowly because these are small strokes. It's not like one big event.
Exactly. It's not one where you see the face fallen or arm, you know, going numb. It's very slow. That's most of the time they don't even know it. They think they might have a headache or just not feel well. So there's not like that person can say, I think I've had, you know, a medical episode or anything like that.
And Michelle Crum, I mean, how many people come to the Alzheimer's Association with that kind of a situation?
You know, we see so many various dementias. We're called the Alzheimer's Association. It used to be Alzheimer's Association and related disorders. We are truly still learning so much about the disease. The more testing they do, the more types of dementia that they're finding. So we don't discriminate between a caregiver that has vascular dementia with their loved one versus Alzheimer's, Lewy body dementia, frontal temporal lobe dementia. The caregiver burden is much the same, and so we try to provide that support.
So, Deneen Day, your mother has vascular dementia. How long? Tell us a little bit about the timeline of your caring for her.
Sure. She was officially diagnosed in 2009, but as the doctor said earlier, there were probably some things that were happening and being, you know, her daughter, I was in denial. Mm-hmm. So she has been in the decline of it since 2009. That is where the caregivers just have to manage with that. And with that diagnosis, you're met with all types of questions and
how has it
issues.
Changed your life?
Oh, it I tell you, and I wish I was the only one, but when you're looking at a disease that has no cure, has no verified way of slowing it down, and they basically pass from a failure to thrive. So you're watching somebody. It's not a sprint. It's not a short disease. It's a very long disease where you watch somebody who was very vibrant, very independent, very capable of doing things on their own, and watch their ability to enjoy life. Their quality of life just goes away from them. And that's very hard for a child or for a spouse to see.
What were the signs that finally caught your attention?
My mother's been very independent. She's traveled all over the world by herself. Just little nuances of where, for example, losing keys. We can go back and trace back where keys are, but her keys up in the freezer or in certain areas.
That's what they say. It's not unusual to lose your keys. Thank you. It's where you find them.
Exactly. And just a lot of caregivers, mail not being open. If it is opening, not understanding that it's a bill and how to pay a bill. Forgetting to go places. I have a son, so a grandson. She was very intricately involved in caring for him. And so those types of things just start to add up. Unfortunately, like they said earlier, a lot of people have coexisting medical conditions. So if they're not caring for those other conditions too, then those start to also exacerbate the dementia that's onsetting too.
Michelle Crum, what are some other common signs, symptoms that people should look for, besides the keys in the freezer, which is a classic? Yeah.
Well, I love to talk about the visual perception.
Yeah.
I think that's really important because you'll start to see individuals with dementia that are losing weight, and there are a number of reasons that could be happening. But things like food that doesn't appear on the plate. You know, if you've got a white plate and you've got turkey and gravy and mashed potatoes, a person with dementia might not see that food or know how to process to eat that meal. It might be that there's a pork chop that is needing a fork and a knife to utilize, you know, to cut the food to eat it. It could be that they always wore a button-up blouse, but now they're struggling with the coordination of buttoning, so they're wearing the same clothes over again because it's what's easy to wear.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of different things like that that when you look back, they stand out. You're like, oh, that's why that happened. Individuals maybe don't drink a glass of water because it's a clear glass and there's water in it, and they might not see that there's water in it. And it's not until the person sits down across from them, picks up a glass and drinks it, that cues them that it's okay, that there's something in that glass to drink. So it's really interesting when you look over all the different pieces.
Mm-hmm. Deneen Day, tell us about what you do for your mother now.
Well, as I talk about caregiving, it's the gamut of it. You're basically taking over everything that person has to do. So my mother lived with us from 09 until 14. And from that time, I'm a typical sandwich generation. I had a son and I was taking care of my mother. So you're talking about medication management. You're talking about their safety. So if you're working full time, you're worried all day long if they're at home by themselves, whether they're going to make, you know, choices that they're not able to comprehend the mm-hmm. risk of it. Making meals because of the risk, they usually either forget how to use a microwave or can't, for safety, use a stove. So you're making all the meals for them. You're also medical appointments where we would go, and I use the example, an eye appointment with somebody with dementia takes a lot longer for us. If you do the what's better, one or two, an eye appointment.
It's hard enough.
They can't do those types of things. So a medical appointment is, you know, getting them ready to go, transporting them there, and then sometimes it's a very long process.
Sitting right in there with
sit
them.
There and giving history of what's going on. So you just do those things, and it adds up. A lot of them have paranoia, have hallucinations, and so your sleep, you have sleep deprivation because you're worried about what is what I call actionable hallucinations or
where they
things,
get up and they're
acting upon what they see or what they hear. So as a caregiver, you kind of get lost in taking care of them and not taking care of yourself because you're going to these appointments, you're trying to find answers, you're trying to manage their life.
And of course, the irony there, Michelle Crum, is that sleep is really important. We know now it helps your brain. It's brain health is sleep. But when you're taking care of somebody where it affects your sleep, mm-hmm. it's like a double whammy.
I've seen that be the straw that broke the camel's back. For a lot of situations, we encourage respite, so some kind of a break for a caregiver, and that could be just a friend or family member coming over and sitting and helping with a person with dementia. A lot of that happens during the day, and it's really hard to get that support during the night. And so you'll see a lot of caregivers that you know that they're not getting a solid night's sleep, and they fall frail to that. So that's usually that piece where you can't continue to provide that care.
Brad and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hang on. I'm sorry.
Yep.
Here we go. I had to get you off speaker.
Sure.
Hey, real quick, I know you guys got to go soon, but I was wondering, you know, we're focusing on memory here, but of course the brain does everything else, like regulates heartbeat and all those things. How do these diseases affect that part of the brain, that motor function and whatever else might not be memory related?
Michelle Crum?
Sure. The balance and coordination is a big part of this disease, and it's really where those plaques and tangles develop. And it starts out with the short-term memory, but it does eventually move throughout the brain, and you see that balance and coordination become a part of it. And as Deneen said, people do eventually die from this disease. Most often, another illness will take their life, whether it's an infection of some sort. But But if left to its own progression, it will, you know, your body tells your throat to swallow. Your body tells your mouth to chew, to breathe. All those different functions start to shut down.
Brad, thanks a lot for that call. Deneen Day, you said your mother from 2009 to 2014 lived with you. And then what triggered, I guess she doesn't live with you anymore.
Correct.
What was that like?
Basically, friends and doctors said you've done enough. My body was absorbing a lot of the caregiver stress. And then she suffered a fall due to the balance issues. And at that point, I just knew I couldn't give the care that I could and also take care of myself.
So what's it like trying to find a place for her to stay?
It's tough. It is financially for families. It is a huge impact. The cost of care is extremely high. The cost of care to get all of the care that you provided at home becomes even more when they need more care, mm-hmm. when the level of care goes up. Most families have a huge financial hit.
Most people go on Medicaid.
They can. A lot of families, my mom has a pension. They have a pension that you think is good enough to carry them out through the rest of their life. They don't make – it's too much to be on most of the programs and make them eligible for the Medicaid.
So you have to sacrifice that then.
But they make not enough to pay for their care.
Right.
So it's family members and others putting towards their care out of pocket. Mm. And so that becomes an extreme cost.
Sheila in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. My husband has frontotemporal dementia, and that's another form of dementia that actually has – onset as young as 40. My husband was 50, so in his prime earning years when he was fired from 10 or 15 jobs after that. We only finally got a diagnosis when he was 64.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, and the caregiving issues are real different when it's your spouse in your home and you have children. And one interesting thing in Central Ohio, there's no specific support group for FTD. I was driving to Newark. That was the closest support group once a month for that. I'm trying to see about getting something started. But there's other support groups like for Alzheimer's or other caregivers. But it's such a different thing. It's a different kind of disease where main thing is personality change. You basically kind of watch the person you married kind of turn into somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a different kind of support need.
Melissa Crum, I imagine there's some demand for what, I'm sorry, Michelle,
that's
I imagine
right.
There's some demand for what Sheila is talking about.
There is. A lot of the individuals that are suffering from frontal temporal lobe dementia will participate in our young onset or earlier stage support groups because they are in that age group before 65.
Uh-huh.
So in our Journeys education program that is for early stage program, those you'll see a mix of those individuals. You'll see people that have been diagnosed with Lewy body or frontal temporal lobe. So, and it's a very devastating form of dementia.
Yeah. Sheila, thanks a lot. Hang in there. That's all you could say. But what does help, Deneen? We're just about out of time, but
sure.
What helped you?
The Alzheimer's Association does have a number of services. Support groups are very important. You have to be able to reach out and be able to cry, laugh, and engage with people that are in this journey. Like she said, children are caregivers by default. So you really have to figure out to make yourself healthy so that you can parent that child through it. And so those are two main important things is caring for yourself and kind of putting yourself first, and then also making sure that the people around, including the children, have the support they need.
Well, Deneen Day, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Deneen Day, she is a local woman whose mother has vascular dementia and spent 5 years living with her and helping her out. Michelle Crum, thanks to you. Sorry about your name.
That's all.
Michelle Crum is the education coordinator for the Central Ohio chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thanks to Aaron Kinkley for producing this show. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.